Welcome back to 1001 Albums Podcast. Today I'll be discussing Amy Winehouse Back to Black with Katie Georgiou from the Sound Effects Podcast.
It's a lot more, I don't want to say more raw, but it's not got all the clever, like, jazz chords. It's not really like that now. We listen to a lot of girl groups, a lot of garage bands. That's kind of what it's like. It's a lot more guitar. I mean, I'm a guitarist. I've been listening to a lot more guitar bands. I mean, in Camden, you can't really get away from it, so...
You can't.
It's rubbed off on me.
Would you go as far as say it's a bit more accessible than your debut?
I say it was more accessible. It's not necessarily more poppy, but... You know, jazz is quite an exclusive, it's quite an elitist music, you know, and this album's a lot less like that.
Was that a conscious decision?
No, it's just what I've been listening to, rubbing off on me, definitely.
And what would you say the main theme is?
It's the same as the last one. It's about, you know, things going wrong.
And what particularly, if you can be specific, went wrong during the time when you were making this album?
I think my ex-boyfriend and I did everything, the most horrible things that two people could do to each other, that love each other, could do to each other. And I think it was a case that we met too young. We weren't prepared, you know, for the way we felt about each other. It's too much. Burnt out. It's too intense.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
So welcome to 1001 Albums, Katie Georgiou. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Very good. Still, wonderful. I'm still in lockdown, actually.
Are you?
I'm locked down myself, yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. And people will know you if they know us from the Oasis podcast, because you've been a regular guest over there. But it's your first time over here on these shores. And we were going to talk about What's the Story, Morning Glory.
But yeah.
Oh, come on. Let's talk about something else. I'm sick of talking Oasis all the time. Yeah. Let's talk about something else. And I think the fact today is the 9th anniversary of the sad death of Amy Winehouse. So we thought, a better time than any to talk about her absolutely incredible second album, Back to Black.
Back to back, yeah.
And you've got a bit of a, I didn't know this, like, but yeah, you mentioned that you've got a slight bit of history with Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, I have. So nobody really knows this, but I went to school with her. She was in the year below me. And I knew her, actually. And, well, the thing is, I don't even know where to begin with this, because nobody really ever reports that she went to a private school for 2 years. So I think it might be mentioned in her Wikipedia, I'm not sure. But she came to my school for 2 years between the age of 14 and 16.
Right.
So when she was doing her GCSEs. And I've got a few stories about that I thought I might share with you if you're interested to know about what went on in those 2 years.
Oh, definitely. I mean, 14 to 16 as well, that's really important. That's typically like a massively important time for people. So please carry on.
Yeah. So basically, I think what had happened was she'd been to Sylvia Young, I believe, just before. And I think the rumour had it, or the myth had it, that she was expelled from there, although people aren't sure if she was actually expelled or not. But my first memory of her is I was at school walking down like the front entrance. There was like this big staircase that you walk down. And she walked in with her mum. She had a guitar on her back, which was very unusual in my school to see anyone with guitars or anything like that, because we were all just kind of, I don't know, for the most part, just quite academic girls, I guess. And so, yeah, in she walks with this guitar on her back. And the first thing I see is our teacher called Mrs. Lansdowne. She was our biology teacher, reprimanding her, going, "Are you going to behave here? Because we don't tolerate any of this nonsense in this school." And I thought, oh, what's, yeah, it's like, what's going on here? So, like, I stopped at the staircase and just was kind of observing what was going on. Thinking, what's going on? I've never seen this girl before. Mm. And so, like, I could hear her go, yeah, I'm gonna behave. Don't worry. So, like, this teacher walks off. And I was looking down. I was like above the staircase looking down at Amy and her mum. And Amy turned around and looked up at me. And she looked me up and down, like head to toe, with this really slow stare. I don't know if you kind of remember that kind of look that she gives, where she kind of gives you a death stare. She gave me this death stare, head to toe. Then turned back to her mum and said, "Oh, I've not seen anyone call yet."
Harsh. How harsh is that?
I know. But then I was like, oh. So, like, I went back to my classroom because our school was really small. I mean, there was about 300 girls in my secondary school.
Right.
So everybody kind of got to know everyone quite quickly. And I remember, like, going back to my classroom, my year group, and saying to, like, one of my friends, "Yeah, there's this, like, new girl that's just walked in, and, like, Miss Lansdowne's just had a go at her, and she's, like, holding a guitar, and she's just said that I'm not cool." And straight away, like, everyone, like, jumps up and is like, "Who is this person?" And I remember a couple of my friends went to, like, investigate. It was, like, some weird operation. Like, from the second she arrived at school, everyone was interested in who she was.
Wow.
Running to go and find her and see what they could find out.
Meet you downstairs in the bar and home. You're rolled up sleeves in your skull t-shirt.
Like my first interaction with her, and then I found out that she was in the year below me, so she's sort of, I think she's a few months, she would have been a few months younger than me, so she was born in September and I was born in April, so she was in the year below. So she ended up in the class with a few people I was friends with. So although I was never really close to her, she was quite close to some of my friends in the year below. And they would often sort of, what they would often do is they would, like, bunk off lessons and then go, there was a cemetery down the road from our school that they would go and sit in, and, like, she would smoke weed and stuff there. Right. And they would write each other notes in RE, and, like, Amy would write notes about how bored she is and stuff like that. It's really interesting. There are so many stories. I don't quite know where to start, honestly.
So was she like a rebel then, sort of straight away? She was like, oh, she was a bad girl from the year below.
She wasn't so much a bad girl, but she was really, really interesting. Like, she was kind of, she didn't give a shit,
right,
basically, about what anyone thought of her. She was definitely her own person. She was definitely singing from then. She would regularly burst into song. So I've got memories I've got memories of like walking to class and her being behind me and her just bursting into song in my ear. Like she would be quite random like that in that sense. Like she would just, wherever she was, she would just burst into song, and it wouldn't matter whether it was like on her way to class or in the middle of a class, she would just burst into song. So she kind of became known for that.
Right.
And
what sort of music is she? Because was she also doing like, you know, because obviously she was having been to the performing arts school beforehand. So was she kind of doing performance stuff and like, oh, this is like, this girl's a singer, and she's like, were people like picking her out and things?
Yeah, so she was actually doing an A-level in drama ahead of her time. So she was, although she was studying her GCSEs, she was able to do A-level drama at 15. So I remember that. And she was always known as a jazz singer, because I do remember one of the teachers saying, like, Amy sings jazz. And she was really, really passionate about jazz music, and she would always be up in the music room. So there were two friends I had that were often up in the music room with her, and they would just like play music together and play guitar. I don't think they didn't necessarily like form a band or anything, but they were just sort of jamming together.
Right.
So I remember like people saying that she was always up in that music room, and she would spend whole lunch hours in there. But one amazing thing that did happen is I was walking, so it's a bit embarrassing because it's a story about the school toilets, but there was one afternoon at lunchtime, I went into the school toilets and no one was in there. And she must have not realised that I was in there, because about 5 minutes later I heard the door swing open, and it sounds really bizarre, but like whilst I was having a wee, I heard her burst into song in the school toilets, but because of the acoustics it was like ricocheting around the whole toilet, so it was, she thought she was on her own.
Right.
So she was singing full pelt at the top of her lungs, and I literally had a concert.
Wow.
I had an Amy Winehouse concert to myself whilst in the cubicle. And I remember, I didn't know it was her. All I heard was this voice. And I remember thinking, wow, like, I do remember thinking, this is extraordinary. Like, I'd never heard anything like that before. It was really beautiful, and I remember like really kind of surreptitiously coming out of the toilet cubicle, like sort of not wanting to ruin this moment. And then I was just like like the little door squeaking, and I said, was that you singing? And She was putting her eyeliner up. She was wearing eyeliner even from then.
Right.
She had this habit of, she would always be in a mirror sort of putting the eyeliner on. And she just kind of looked at me through the mirror. And as she didn't actually move her head, she just looked through the mirror at me and continued to put her eyeliner on and went, yeah, that was me.
Do you remember what she was singing?
I don't remember. It wasn't a famous song. I think she was just sort of, I wouldn't remember what the song was. It was just kind of full pelt of something. Right. I'm imagining it was some jazz song, but it wasn't anything recognizable. But she did used to do that a lot. She would just burst into song wherever she was. And yeah, that was kind of cool. And I always remember that because I think, wow, like I basically had a little concert that no one knew about, which was really, really amazing. Wow.
And she didn't know about it either. That's
she didn't know.
That's the fascinating thing, I suppose, isn't it? Because you know, to catch someone when they know that they're, when they don't realize they're being listened to, I suppose that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's, you know, just knowing you're being listened to instantly would change how you would do it. But yeah, that is fascinating. Wow, amazing.
'Cause I've forgotten all of young love's joy. Feel like a lady and you my lady boy. Used to be stronger than me, but instead you're longer than frozen turkey. Why'd you always put me in control?
Cool. All right. Any other little stories from that time?
There's a couple of other stories. So one was she actually wanted to sing in our school. We had like a school concert, and she wanted to be the lead, and basically you had like a whole chorus of us in the background. So, you know, these sort of really cheesy school productions where there's like, I think we were singing Feed the World or something, like Michael Jackson, something really cheesy. And, you know, you've got this background of us going, Feed the World, make it a better, like, I can't sing. So, and then she's like layering over the top of it in her voice. So it didn't match at all, because she's got this real jazz voice and then we're all singing in this kind of like weird cacophony. And she would sing, and the singer would, the teacher would stop and say, Amy, you're going to have to tone that down a bit because it doesn't work. It doesn't chime in mix with the rest of the singing. So she got quite upset about that, and she was like, but this is how I sing, like, what do you want me to do? Like, they were like, you're just gonna have to tone down that kind of vocal that you're doing and just sing normally. So she tried, and it didn't work, and there was a big drama where she stormed out of the assembly of the hall. She just stormed off and refused and said, well, I'm not doing it then. And the teacher was like, leave her, girls, leave her, she's just a prima donna, just let her be.
Oh my god, that's brilliant, isn't it? Like, you wouldn't it would be so bad if you were just like, yeah, she was just a nice girl, you know, just did what she was told. It would be so disappointing. It's great to hear that, you know, that the seeds of what she became was always there.
Yeah, she was a very interesting character. I mean, she would she had her piercing from then as well, and she had a nipple piercing as well, which she liked to show people as well. I don't know if she had it in later years, but I don't know. But yeah, there was she was a very interesting character. And I think the thing that strikes out for me is that you knew from then she definitely was different. And it's not that I thought she would ever be, I didn't look at her and think, oh, she's going to be famous. Right. But when she became famous, it was clear, like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, she was always different. And I kind of almost, I sort of imagine her on the same level as how I imagine Liam would have been at school, where people said, you know, you know how many people say he was a character.
Yeah.
Like, Amy was a character, and very much her own person, quite antagonistic, really didn't care what people thought of her. Also quite childlike in some ways. There was something at times quite childlike and naive about her, which I thought was quite interesting as well. And I think I do remember her mum. I remember her dad coming to pick her up from school once, I think, or it might have been. But yeah, I do remember those times. So yeah, those are my stories of Amy Winehouse.
Wow! And so then, as her like career then started to happen, when did she sort of come onto your horizon then, in that, like, oh wow, I went to school with her?
Yeah, it was I recognized her name instantly because she had such a distinctive name and everyone in the school knew her name. And it was in 2003 Mm-hmm. I was living in France at the time because I was studying French at uni, so I went to France, and I was reading this, I think it was a student newspaper or something, and they had a little review of different albums in the art section, and it had a little picture and it said Amy Winehouse, and I remember thinking, I recognize that name. That's Amy who I went to school with. So I was like, oh, okay. So I looked her up, and then it was a review of Frank. And I was like, oh my God, it is actually, that's her. And then pretty quickly, a few of my friends sort of started to mention it as well. And people were saying, oh, Amy's become famous now. And I think people started commenting that she'd lost a lot of weight and was looking a lot different, because by that point it was sort of edging in between sort of Frank and Back to Black.
Yeah.
So that would have been around the time that she would have broken up from Blake. I mean, I didn't know her at all during that period, but some of my friends did, and some of my friends stayed friends with her in that time, and I think they had commented that she had like lost a lot of weight and was really different. And that was sort of obviously just before Back to Black came out, and then it all just blew up, and it was like, oh my God, that she was at our school. That's mad, like, you know.
I know, it's crazy. And the Frank album was one that that we had in the house, and it was one that like I did listen to quite a bit when it came out. But just like, oh, there's this cool, you know, there's this cool, like, you know, jazz pop singer who's like got a little bit different, you know, and a bit of a different style. There's a song called Fuck Me Boots, isn't there? And I was like, wow, yeah, that's like, that's really, yeah, that's it. And it was like, that is so cool that she's just, you know, this isn't the typical kind of Leona Lewis or whatever. This person's got a bit of attitude about her. And, you know, and I just remember that really brilliant, like front cover, and I think seeing her on Jules Holland and be like, this, she is really talented. This is really cool.
When you walk in the bar and you're dressed like a star, rocking your F me pumps, and the man notice you with your Gucci back crew, can't tell who he's looking to, cause you all look the same, everyone knows.
But then, yeah, then when Back to Black came out, and it's like, you know, and well, there was the Valerie cover, wasn't it? That was then what really pushed her into the next level, which was really cool as well, because Valerie's such a, you know, great song by the Zootons, and what she did with it was just absolutely amazing. But then, yeah, and then Back to Black coming out was just, yeah, this is just something else. This is like, it was funny, I listened to it again today. I hadn't really listened to it a lot. I did listen to it quite a few times when it came out. I then re-listened to it when I interviewed Chris Elliott, the string arranger, because he'd, I interviewed him for the Oasis podcast, because he arranged strings and brass on Liam's last album, and then hearing him, and I had no idea he'd worked with Amy Winehouse, and then he just said, oh yeah, and I did Amy Winehouse Back to Black album, you know, with Mark Ronson. I was like, wait, whoa. I know we have to talk about Liam, but you don't just let that one go. Let's talk about that, you know. So I tell you what, I think we'll drop in a little bit of that conversation here.
First thing I knew about it, I was in my studio. It was a Friday afternoon. I got a call from the A&R department of Island Records asking whether I'd be interested in writing string arrangements for the next Amy Winehouse album. Like, would I be interested? I think that anyone who loves music, who heard the first album, Frank, would know, would just think this is going to be amazing. She's an incredible talent.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was really keen. They said, right, well, the session's booked for Monday, you know, and it was Friday. So not only do you get an incredible opportunity to work with someone like Amy Winehouse, but there's hardly any time to do a great job, you know. So I managed to negotiate it to Tuesday.
Wow.
They said, Mark can come and see you later this afternoon, and he just wants to go through the songs with you very quickly. They managed to send the songs over. I did a few sketches really quickly, just almost busking straight away. Luckily, you know, the songs weren't complicated in terms of harmony and chords and stuff.
And so can I just clarify the three songs here? They're three quite good songs. Rehab, Back to Black, and Love is a Losing Game.
That's it.
Is that correct?
That is it, yeah.
Well, that's, Chris, that's three of the best songs of the 21st century.
Well, and it's amazing, isn't it, that the opportunity came that quickly and had to be done so fast. And I suppose maybe there's, you know, something to be said for spontaneity with all of this. So I was told that Mark, who I hadn't met, by the way, was going to be appearing at my studio later that afternoon. And I think the buzzer went about 4:30. He appeared. He had a guitar with him and a backpack. And I think he'd just flown in from Dublin, having done a DJ gig there, and he needed to go in half an hour to get to the airport to go to Edinburgh, because it was the summer, it was the festival, and he was going to be up there DJing again. I was really impressed that he was going to play guitar on his DJ set. I thought that was just superb.
And we
got on really well. He was quite naive about strings. You know, he hadn't done it before, really. And he was really excited about it. And unbeknown to me, he said to Amy, if you don't like the strings, I'll pay for them. So there's no problem.
Wow.
It's just a little experiment, you know, between us. I didn't know this, though. So I played him each sort of arrangement, the busk I'd done. He didn't want to add anything. He just wanted to remove notes here and there. But, you know, on the whole, he really liked what I did. And he said, all right, I've got to go. He said, one last thing, though. He said, Amy really hates the idea of doing strings. So can you think of something else that we could do in case, you know? And I was, like, pretty gobsmacked by that. And I said, oh, don't worry. We'll just keep it low and tremmy, i.e. tremolando, you know, spooky.
Okay.
I said, it'd be fine. And then I had another thought. And with the sessions I've been doing with Marius de Vries, like we'd just done Rufus Wainwright, and we would do our big string day in, say, Angel Studios or Abbey Road or somewhere. And we'd have the strings for maybe a couple of sessions in the day. And then in the evening, we'd order a complete percussion fest to be brought in. We'd use one player, but we would have almost everything you could imagine in the room. Timps, tubular bells, xylophone, vibes, great big grand cassa, bass drum type thing, you know, everything. And then we would sort of improvise a percussion session from the string charts that we used earlier. So for this, I suddenly thought, oh, hang on, Mark, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll order a load of percussion and we'll get Frank Ricotti, who is the absolute percussion master, to come and play at 6 o'clock on the day. And that way we can cover ourselves with something, at least, if the strings weren't accepted. And he was happy with that. On that session, we were in Metropolis, which is a really unusual place to record strings because it's a very hard-standing room. And I think with strings, you either have a lovely big ambience, like in Abbey Road Studio One or Air, Lyndhurst Hall, for kind of cinematic sound, or you have a kind of tight room for, say, you know, a really rhythmic rock and roll session. That's where we did Liam's stuff in Abbey Road 2 for that very reason. So there wasn't loads of spill on it. But with the Amy thing, we were at Metropolis, and I think that made the strings sound kind of hard and quite 60s, you know, which he liked, Mark loved. But he chose that studio because they were mixing there and it was going to be convenient. I think Tom was mixing up in Studio E or F, one of those. And we were down in Studio A, which was their biggest studio. And we did the strings, I think, first off. We then did a horn session where we wanted to just have another go at Rehab. I don't know why we did it, because Mark loved how it sounded from the original recording, which was done at Daptone Studios in Brooklyn.
I was going to say, it's the Dap Kings, isn't it? From Daptones, who did the Sharon Jones, and I love that, those guys. That is just the best modern soul music.
Absolutely, 100%. So we did that, but the brass that we did on Love is a Losing Game, that was a different matter altogether. So Love is a Losing Game didn't have any brass on it. And I had done a very basic sort of chord sort of arrangement for the horns to play. And I think we sort of had two trumpets, two trombones, two saxes of some sort, something like that. And I just asked the players to play really quietly and warm, and the trumpets are low, and with nice vibrato. And so that texture you can hear in Lovers and Losing Game is a result of that. Then we did the percussion session. Frank was there playing the timps. And Amy appeared. Someone had told her to go and look at what was in the live room because it looked really impressive. I've got a photograph of it. I'll try and find it for you. And Frank was actually playing the timps at this point. And I had said to Frank, I'm going to give you the bass line of Back to Black. And he kind of looked at me in a sort of slightly puzzled way and said, what, the whole thing? And I said, yes, yes. And so he kind of starts off, dum, 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 you know, bum, 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 you know, etc. And at some point he stopped, he put his hand up and he said, look, timps don't play all the way through songs like this. So I had to say, look, with all due respect, Frank, we are going to do this, you know, we're going to do this. So he's the nicest guy, and he was really just messing around. I think he was terrified that every timing error would have to be corrected, and it was just going to, you know, take forever. For me, I should have explained to him that, you know, the sound of the timps was really going to be just tucked in low, and it was just almost like the aura of the low end of the timp is what we were going to hear. It was just going to be that. It wasn't going to be the main part of the song by any means. And Amy did come in at this point on her own, and she was wearing a little kind of white dress, like a little wisp of white with massive black hair came in, and she sort of like looked at me with the eye and then sort of sat down at the back of the studio, sort of slinky like, and just stayed listening to the timps for a while. And then, you know, she sort of got up and she nodded to us and went out, and that was it.
Wow.
There's another thing that we did on that track that's quite unique. There's a thing you can do with the vibraphone where you get a double bass bow, which is like a really, really strong bow, and you put the pedal down on the vibraphone, rather like putting the pedal down on a piano, and it sustains the sound. It takes the dampers off the bar. And you draw the bow upwards on the bar, the metal bar, and it produces an incredible sound. It's like a science fiction sound. It's a really beautiful harmonics. And I said to Frank, I'm going to give you the viola part of Love is a Losing Game. And so one of the assistants goes in with the part. And Frank's looking at this. And I said, what could you play on this? And it was literally just like semi-briefs, like a whole bar note for each chord change. There's nothing more complex in the part than that. And I said, what about every other note? And he said, yeah, that's totally doable. And so the track starts, and then he comes in and he draws the first one. And as he draws the bow up, there isn't really any sound, but then he's about halfway up with the bow, and then this aura of sound comes out, like a beautiful orb of colour, you know, appearing. And it blurs into the next chord, and then he starts the next chord, and then that blurs. And when you listen to the track, there's something gluing the horns, these beautiful soft horns, and the strings together. And it's the vibraphone being bowed by Frank.
Wow.
There's something about the song that is wonderful and unexpected and perfect and totally bespoke to her thing, her voice.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think that the arrangement does really contribute there. So when Mark finally played it to her, I think he was basically had his head in his hands, and she had her head on the desk of the mixing desk, not looking at anyone. And he was literally just terrified that she was going to hate it, you know, because he really loved it. And the song finished, and she apparently just stayed still for about 10, 15 seconds.
Right.
And then she just turned to him quite quickly and said, I love it.
Wow.
It was great. We had the right approach. On Back to Black, we went full orchestral kind of sounding, you know, cinematic. And in fact, the middle part of that, I was hearing something quite, you know, filmic, anthemic.
Yeah. Well, when it breaks down.
Yeah.
When everything cuts out, when she goes, just goes black, yeah, black,
that's
that bit.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the movement, the strings just hold there high as she does that, as the breakdown happens. Then they start to move in a particular way that I suppose kind of reminded me of Ennio Morricone kind of thing. However, that links back to Stronger, and middles became my little signature because it's somewhere where you can do something different. And often they do break down, so there is an opportunity there. It's not like you're cluttering something up. So, you know, being an arranger, it's all about not getting in the way of the important stuff. But when the opportunity presents itself to take full advantage of it and create a moment, that's where you can kind of try and shine.
So, I mean, what was your impression when you first heard Back to Black?
Well, I loved it. And the song I remember was Rehab, because that I remember that came out like towards the end of 2006, and I was doing a little bit of traveling around that time, and then suddenly I heard this song and I thought, oh my god, it's like, you know, she's become international. It was really bizarre, but I loved it. I really loved that song and thought, god, it's really catchy. I didn't know at that point that she'd gone through all of that, so I didn't realize that the lyrics were connected to her actual experiences. But I do remember just thinking it's really catchy. It reminded me of like the sort of 60s you know, like 60s girl groups, and I loved that. And it was a really short pop song that just, yeah, it was really catchy, and I thought it had a lot of energy, and I was really excited by it. I loved it.
Well, it's so cool, isn't it, as well, like that I mean, it's become part of the fabric of, you know, society now. Everyone knows that song, but it's so cool, like, you know. And it's great that the you know, I'd listened to it on headphones today, and actually really thinking about it and listening to it, you've got that like Ray Charles organ in the background, and the fact she references, you know, Ray Charles and Donny Hathaway and people like that. But it's really like, it's so catchy, you know, they try to make me go to rehab, I say no. It's just like, it's almost comical, but it's so good. But then the fact it is tied in with the lyrics, you know, it's... Yeah. You know, and we knew at the time as well, or it was stories were started to come out about her personal problems. But yeah, so it was very interesting.
Rehab was when I got myself into a real dark place, and my friend of mine called my dad and said, you've got to come and sort her out, because we don't know what we're doing with her. She doesn't talk to anyone. She's nuts. She's drinking as soon as she wakes up. She's mad. My dad comes around. My dad bursts into tears. And my dad's quite soppy, but if my dad cries, I'll be like, I'll do anything, Dad. I'll do whatever you want me to do. So I want to stay with him. And then my managers came for me and goes, we're going to take you to this place. So I went down there. I met up with the fella. He said, why do you think you're here? I said, because I do drink a lot. I think it's symptomatic of my depression. Like, I'm a manic depressive. I'm not an alcoholic, which sounds like an alcoholic in denial. And he goes, oh, will you fill in this form? I said, how long does it take? He said, half an hour. I said, you know what? I don't want to waste your time anyway still. Meanwhile, my managers are in the pub down the road having, like, Sunday roast. It's a joke.
So the line, they wanted me to go to rehab, and I said, no, that is actually what happened.
Yeah.
You were like, nope, I'm not up for it.
Well, it was 10 weeks. I mean, you can hear it in the lyrics. It was 70 days, 10 weeks. And I just thought, nah, do they have a gym there? what's going to happen to my, who's going to feed my cats? Who's, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
real practical,
like,
issues.
The thing is that, you know, alcoholism is a horrible thing, but if you can't remember the practical issues, that's when you know you've got a real problem.
So your cat saved you from rehab?
They did. Thank you, Monkey. Thank you, Melina.
Lyrically, I didn't realise how great her lyrics were until the Amy documentary came out, when they started putting the little snippets of her lyrics on the songs. That's when it really struck me, like, the level of, they're just so clever. Yeah. Like, from the way that they rhyme to the imagery and the metaphor and the sadness of them, but the cheekiness of them, just really clever.
Yeah, definitely. There's quite a few little one-liners in there that just really, like, make you smile and make you chuckle. And she's not, you know, she's got no, you know, she's not ashamed to talk about, you know, sex and things like that. It's just like, she's just so clever and so, you know, brash in that way. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, the, you know, the, that just the way her wordplay and stuff, she's a great songwriter. Like, people think about her as this amazing singer, and the, obviously the image, and then all the, you know, and now that obviously since her sad death, everything, that's kind of what we think now when we think of Amy Winehouse, but she's got to be one of the greatest songwriters of our all time, you know, if you think about it. And, you know, obviously it's so sad that we'll only ever have these two albums now, but I mean, what a two albums, and this album specifically, absolutely,
you know,
amazing.
I saw a YouTube clip of her recently where she said something like she just hopes that she's considered a proper musician.
Right.
And I thought that was so interesting, because it was the interview was well into her Back to Black phase. And she seemed really quite shy about it in this interview. I can't remember who was interviewing her, but I'll try and find the link and send it to you if you want to. But yeah, she's saying, I just want people to believe that I'm a proper musician. And she absolutely is.
Well, not just that. I mean, it's the, you know, that voice, but yeah, it's the writing, the lyrics are so good, you know, and the, as well, the ability to take all these different influences and understand, you know, and have such a unbelievable knowledge about music and such a love and passion for music, and really bring that all in together into that album. And it was so different. And when you look back at, you know, a lot of the stuff that kind of followed in her wake, you know, there's so many sort of like Adele and Duffy and all these sort of people that came after her that sort of did that kind of, you know, like new soul, really taking that sort of 60s soul sound. But they were, as much as those guys have got talent, there's, you know, Amy was just a one-off, wasn't she? Just a step above all them, I think. For me, I mean, when you look at that album, I mean, going through the album, I think the last three tracks are like, you know, are good, but the first, as you go back, it's like, wait, is this the greatest hits? You know, you go like, Rehab, You Know I'm No Good, Tears Dry on Their Own, Love Is a Losing Game. It's like, these are all absolute classics.
Yeah.
Tears Dry on Their Own is my favorite, because I absolutely love Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell. And it samples a Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell song in the background. And so, you know, but it's just so good. Like the, you know, to take that sample, but then do something so extra and different and special with it. So that's the one that gets me.
I knew I had him at my match, but every moment we get snatched. I don't know why I got so attached. It's my responsibility
And you don't own nothing to me but to walk away. I have no capacity. He walks away, the sun goes down, he takes the day, but I'm grown. And in your way, in this blue shade, my tears dry on their own.
But they're all just so cool and so brilliantly produced as well, with Mark Ronson and with those with the Daptones, the band from that played with Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings and all those. And it's just such a rich sounding album to me.
Yeah, and what I really love is that when she would play them live, she would change them. And I love how she will improvise every time she sang one of those songs. She would just improvise it slightly and change it slightly, and it would always just be so unexpected, and it wouldn't even necessarily be the same melody. I think I noticed that with I think it was with Love Is a Losing Game, she did that where she just sang on a completely different melody but improvised, and it like whatever was going on musically in the background, she would still stay with her process. And I loved all those versions as well, and it's almost like she rendered them all over again.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's tough because then the touring of this album then sort of coincides with her struggles, you know. And I know there was, like, the Amy documentary covers it very well, doesn't it? That at the time, you know, she was getting booed off stage and things like that, and she was really, really struggling, and she was so thin and just, you know, and the British public, she became a joke, you know, and people were laughing at her. And it was like the regular joke, oh, what's happened to Amy Winehouse this week? And then so, yeah, when she died, it was just awful. I mean, having known her as well, I mean, when was that particularly tough for you?
Yeah, it was really sad. It was really sad. And I think it did sort of bring it home. I think that extra layer of thinking, oh, God, like, yeah, I knew her. I remembered her. I remember what she looked like. She didn't look right. I mean, she looked like how she looked when she was on the Frank album in those years. That's exactly how she looked when she was at school. So my memories of her are much more like that. I think there's something about, even if you've met someone briefly for even 5 minutes in a cafe or something, and then you hear that something's happened to them, it just adds that extra layer of, oh, that's, you know, that's really sad. It took me quite a while to stop feeling sad about that, I think. But then I think a lot of people feel that way.
I think especially when an artist is so when there is so much their personality in the music as well, isn't it? Like, if when someone's like just a normal pop star dies, it's sad. But when it's like, you know, you feel like we didn't know her, you knew her a bit, but, you know, the rest of us who didn't know her, it's like we felt like we did know her because we'd been with her on that journey, and we listened to those songs, and they were about her life, and that meant so much to us. And so when she then died, it was like, oh no, it's when people die in that way, I always think it's almost like, you know, she never got her comeback. You know, she was at that real low point. And what you want then, don't you, like a Keith Richards or someone, that, you know, they have that really difficult time, they go away for a few years, and then they come back, and it's all, they have that second phase of their career, and, you know, wasn't it brilliant? They went through that tough times, and now they're back, and it's great. And she never had that comeback, you know, so she'll always be, you know, she's, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's awful, but she's in that 27 club, isn't she, with Morrison and Hendrix and Kurt Cobain. But that is absolutely awful. Well, what a horrible doubt it's kind of leave it on. But I mean, the album itself, Katie, anything else you want to say about it? And what do you think in terms of the, you know, its legacy and history of music?
I think in terms of its legacy and history, I think it will definitely stand the test of time. I think it's gone down in history. She was a superstar. She became an absolute superstar, not just lyrically and musically, but as a person. I think she will always be remembered. And I think the tragedy of it, I think it's a shame that it became like the 27 Club, actually, because this kind of this quite sort of dangerous romanticism that around that idea of drink and drugs, which I think is being challenged a bit now, but it's a shame to think of her as just that when she was so much more. And it's kind of ironic that she was 27. You know, if she'd been 29 or 30, she wouldn't have been lumped in that. But I've actually just remembered that it was around, I think it must have been 2007. I saw her again in Camden, but just randomly. She was going into was it like news agents? Yeah, the paparazzi were swarming her. Like, I just remember walking with a couple of my friends down the pavement on the main Camden High Street, and just suddenly loads of cars just swooping in, and loads of like paparazzi jumping out. And I was like, what is going on? It was just chaos. And then you just saw her with that, you know, trademark beehive, just literally going in, minding her own business to buy like a packet of cigarettes or something. And I just got the sight of that hounding. They really hounded her, and jumping into the news agents, they practically running people over on the pavement just to get a picture of her buying some cigarettes. And I remember thinking, wow, like I wouldn't want to be her right now.
No.
I think I'm left with that kind of sadness, but
for you I was a flame.
Favorite is probably Love Is a Losing Game. I think it's such a clever song, and it's so heartbreaking, and I think it's something that so many people relate to. She just had this ability to capture like real heartbreak, and I think these songs will last forever for sure.
Great. Yeah. Cool. Katie, well, thank you so much for your time today. And
you're welcome. Thanks
really for appreciate having. It. And brilliant. Great to discuss. And I'm sure we'll speak again very soon.
Yeah. I'll chat to you soon, James.
More than I could stand.